Welcome to Reading, Writing, Rolling, Imagination and Fiction in the Age of Harry Potter. This is episode 14, where we will be talking with Karen Cabarly and Louise Freeman about J.K. Rowling's latest writing as Robert Galbraith, the fourth Cormoran Strike book, Lethal White. Thanks for joining us for Reading, Writing, Rolling. I am your host, Katie McDaniel, Professor of History at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2. Our resident expert is John Granger, the Dean of Harry Potter Scholars and author of numerous books about the Harry Potter series, including the Deathly Hallows Lectures. How are you doing today, John?
You know, very well. Thank you. I've had a daughter married in Santa Fe, caught up with friends out there. That was a lot of fun.
Congratulations, Santa Fe, beautiful city.
Oh, my goodness. And I finished a big project at work, and the PhD is coming along, and we're about to roll out a wizard reading formula again. So there'll be more on that in, I hope, our next show.
Oh, wonderful. Okay, very good. Stay tuned, everybody. And, John, I know you're excited for Lethal White September 18th.
I was... Just chatting with a friend here before the show and saying that I have all these things planned for September and then realize, I'll be reading Lethal White September. That's much for that month. I'm very excited about it.
All right. Well, we are joined today by two guests who are scholars ready to take on analysis of the Cormoran Strike series that will hopefully allow us to anticipate some of what we might expect in the fourth book in the series Lethal Whites. Our first guest is Dr. Karen Cabarly, a PhD from UC Berkeley, who teaches English as a second language at the college level in Canada, and who describes herself as a Harry Potter geek from way back. Karen has given many talks at Harry Potter cons and conferences, including last year's MystyCon, and early on jumped on the strike train as a source of great analysis, giving a talk called Harry Potter and Cormoran Strike Get Their Man. Welcome to the show, Karen.
Thank you very much, Katie.
Our next guest is Dr. Louise Freeman. She was a guest on our first ever Reading, Writing, Rolling, and she is coincidentally also a Berkeley PhD.
I am. Thank you.
Louise is professor of psychology at Mary Baldwin University and is a longtime participant in the world of Harry Potter scholarship. And like Karen, she also spoke at MystyCon 2017. And we were trying to figure out if you all had seen each other's talks, maybe, but I suppose there's a lot going on at MystyCon.
Yes, I don't remember seeing Karen's or hearing Karen's. I have a funny feeling we might have been scheduled in the same section and therefore not able to go to each other's.
Yeah, that's always... It's wonderful to have lots of options, but sometimes I feel like it's too many choices.
And I must say, we never knew each other at Berkeley either. 30,000, 40,000 people, psychology majors and English majors don't cross paths that often. So, and it was well before Harry Potter, so... but anyway, I'm happy to make her acquaintance now.
Yes, we're bringing you together across time and the continent, I guess. So, all right. Well, welcome to both Karen and Louise. And I am so excited for this conversation today, where we're going to hopefully tease out some of the connections between Harry Potter and the Cormoran Strike series. So we're really going to delve into J.K. Rowling as a writer and what we can understand about her by looking at these two series together. We can see some, you know, some patterns and maybe even development, evolution, trajectory. We want to look at classical references that emerge in the Cormoran Strike series. And of course, we want to do some prediction for Lethal White, which is due out September 18th, 2018. Before we proceed any further, I do want to warn our listeners that our show will very likely contain spoilers about the first three Strike novels, The Cuckoo's Calling, The Silkworm, and Career of Evil. If you haven't read those, we will be talking about them, and you have been warned. But if you're like me, you don't necessarily mind a spoiler, and sometimes I kind of like it if I'm not sure I want to get into something. And if you're thinking about getting into the Cormoran Strike series, you want to see if it'll be worth it, maybe you'll give us a listen and won't mind a few spoilers. So that's me. Sometimes I like a spoiler. All right, so let's start by just getting a sense of, you know, how you all got interested in the Cormoran Strike novels. So when did, let's start with Karen, when did you realize that the Cormoran Strike novels were going to be as rich a subject for analysis as the Harry Potter series?
I think I just picked up the first book as soon as it came out and read it, and analyzing it was just the natural thing to do. So
it was just immediately obvious to you that this
I guess analysis is just what I do naturally, so I think towards the end of Cuckoo's Calling, I started to see that there were a lot of threads of the story that were going to carry on throughout, and that there was going to be, like in the Harry Potter series, an overarching plot. Mm-hmm. So that always makes things interesting to see that each book has an individual mystery, and then there are relationships and mysteries that are just sort of laid out in the first book and are developed over the next two. So I could see that she was doing the same thing in that sense as in the Harry Potter novels.
Yeah, I think we were talking about how, you know, you can even see she's laying groundwork for future novels, even in that very first one, The Cuckoo's Calling, just like she was doing with Sorcerer's Stone, where she mentions, this is the one that got me, she mentions Sirius Black's bicycle, and then all of a sudden, in book three, he appears again. And we were just talking about how one of the characters in Career of Evil, Noel Brockbank, is that his name?
That's right.
He is actually mentioned in The Cuckoo's Calling as somebody whose case Cormoran Strike still feels somewhat disturbed about. And so she's definitely building those layers, and that was obvious to you right away. That's cool. What about you, Louise? When did you decide that this was something worth talking about?
Well, of course, as soon as the news broke that this book was J.K. Rowling's, which of course the majority of people did not know early on, and I did not pick up the book before that, obviously, like most of the world. But for me, it was, I mean, I read it, I enjoyed it. I can't say that it was inherently obvious to me from the first reading that this was going to go as far as it did. Like with Harry Potter, I fully began to appreciate the complexity when I started talking about it with other readers. I mean, particularly in my case on Hogwarts Professor, which, of course, you can always depend on John to start with a whole list of questions from day one and to start reading it backwards and doing all the fun things he does with it. So it was really that level of discussion. I think that connection with other readers and with other J.K. Rowling fans is essential for developing that appreciation early on.
I agree.
Yes,
I sort of feel like
it's easier to look back once you've had three books come out and you can start seeing these connections, mm-hmm. and these little bits of various other plot lines that are developing over time. But that's not obvious at the beginning, and you don't know what is just sort of a throwaway bit of background versus what is going to turn out to be very important later on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's a level of detail there that, like you say, it's hard to tell what's going to turn out to be important.
I mean, really, Louise's point there is excellent. I mean, yeah, I was right into it because that's what I do. But really, except for conversations with readers like Louise and Karen, who also had seen things clearly that I hadn't seen, and Joanne Gray and Patricia Baker and other people that have contributed to the conversation at Harvard's Professor, there's so much there, but it's really the engagement with other readers that really, just like Harry Potter, that brings out so much more of the excitement and makes you go back and reread and find out why these books are so good. I mean, it was always obvious to me after I learned this was a book by J.K. Rowling. Again, I didn't know who Robert Galbraith was or read the book before it was revealed there. But once you know that it is a book by J.K. Rowling, and you see that there, as Karen said, there is this overarching story. This is going to play out over a series of books. It became very exciting, and then the conversations made it even more so.
You know, I definitely totally agree with that. When I read the first one, Cuckoo's Calling, I could hear that it was J.K. Rowling's voice. That was not a surprise to me. I did know it was her when I was reading it, but I thought, this is obvious from page one because it has the... She talks about a camera having a snout nose, and I was like, oh, you can see there are these characteristic kind of ways of talking, ways of language choice and so on. I thought, this is definitely J.K. Rowling's voice, but some of the analysis and for sure the Harry Potter connections, these were really not obvious to me until I started to read up about it, until I was talking with you, John, particularly about the connections that are evident once you start pursuing them, but they were not obvious to me. So I totally agree with that. That's one of the great things about discussing good books with people who are paying attention. So what are the things that you most appreciate about the Cormoran Strike books? Louise, what do you like most about them? And do you have any frustrations with the series so far?
I've fallen in love with the characters. I mean, I absolutely love Robin. I mean, how can I not love a wannabe psychologist in a J.K. Rowling book? I mean, right, finally, yes, she's put a psychologist in there. Thank you. And just, again, I mean, both of them have this incredibly complex family history. You learn these bits of details that just unfold so gradually, but are clearly leading up to a big overarching story. Now, what's interesting to me, I just reread the first three in preparation for Lethal White coming out. You know, in some ways, we really still don't know what the overarching story is going to be. Even at third, I mean, in Harry Potter, it was pretty obvious. You know, Voldemort versus Harry. Mm-hmm. Voldemort attacked Harry as a baby. There would be a rematch, and you know, good versus evil, and you knew the story was going to continue throughout his 7 years at Hogwarts. We don't quite have that understanding now. I mean, yes, we've heard from one source that there were going to be 7 books. We've heard from other sources that there are going to be more than 7. Is the big story going to be Strike solving the mystery of his mother's death? Is it going to be Strike, you know, being acknowledged as Johnny Rokeby's son and getting the inheritance he is due by virtue of that status? Is it going to be Strike marrying Robin? You know, there's a couple of different ways it could go, and we really don't know for sure that it's going to be the 7. I mean, there is no 7-year school that they're going through that we're going to get to follow them all the way through. So in some ways, it's more open-ended and more, and that, you know, that can be both exciting and also sometimes a little frustrating. It's sometimes nice to have a bit of your path carved out for you to know where you're going. But that's what I most appreciate about the series.
Yeah, there are lots of shades of gray. You were talking about the good and evil being really clear in Harry Potter, and although I think that she has, J.K. Rowling has a real sense of the morality of her moral characters, I do think there's a lot more gray area. I was thinking about in Career of Evil, the Shanker character, who is, he's not really good, but he's not bad. He's on our side, you know.
I mean, he reminds me of Mundungus Fletcher, you know, the sort of the thief, the low class criminal. You've got to, you know, watch your purse when he's around.
Right.
But you know, he's a member of the Order of the Phoenix, and you know, yes, he screws up a lot, but you know, there's a reason Dumbledore has him where he has them. He comes in handy at times, and so I mean, there were characters like that.
Yeah,
all the way through,
that's
Harry
true.
Potter as well as your obvious evil people, Voldemort, Umbridge, are I guess the two obvious ones. I think they're sort of the Whitaker and Rokeby or possibly Matthew. I don't know which
Matthew is more like the Dursleys, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Good point, John. He really is like the Dursleys, only just sort of more educated, but conventional to...
Yes, see, I had almost
bottom of the soul.
Myself, Matthew was more like Dolores Umbridge, and that no one could possibly like him for any reason. But maybe he is more like the Dursleys.
I'll tell you, as the man in the room, that Matthew is the most disturbing character, because inevitably you see either stupid things that you've said, or worse things that you've thought and haven't expressed. I mean, oh, it's a horrifying image for to read. Oh. Anyways, it's like the Dursleys when you're a parent. You're like, oh, here I am.
Oh, yeah, right. You see a little more of yourself in some of these characters than you wish you did.
Everybody wants to be Robin and Cormoran. You know, that's great. Oh, yeah, we're on board with those guys. But when you see characters that are just gross, and yet they're so well drawn that they're realistic. Boy.
Yeah. She's kind of merciless in the Cormoran Strike books in the way that she draws her characters, so that you really see them, flaws and all.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you like, Karen?
Well, I like the Robin and Strike interaction. That's my very favorite thing.
Absolutely.
And I was just reading that Rowling likes that the best too, and she said the plot of future novels is a lot about the developing relationship between them, like friendship, and she didn't specify what would happen.
Yeah.
But I think that it's just such a pleasure to watch them interact, and There's something very believable and endearing about their banter and how they come to slowly care about each other as people, and maybe more. So I absolutely love that. I like the Matthew, how Robin keeps making bad decisions in regards to Matthew, because I think a lot of us have been there. I certainly have. Where you stay with someone who really, as Strike says, won't let you be yourself.
Uh-huh.
Because of all kinds of reasons, like long time, you've been with them for a long time, and you have all this emotion and sentiment and loyalty. So I do enjoy that. What I find frustrating is how Strike is such a jerk sometimes.
Uh-huh.
Like, one thing I like very much about the TV series is that he is a very believable possible partner for Robin, whereas the Strike in the book, it's hard for me to imagine this cranky man like being a good partner for Robin in the long run. But intellectually, yes, but emotionally, he just is carrying so much baggage.
Yeah, I do think the TV series, it's interesting. If you really like the relationship between Cormor and Strike and Robin, I've Googled it. It's Tom Burke is Tom Cormor Burke. And Strike, and Holiday Granger is another Granger. Robin Ellicott. And if you really like that, the series does, I think it definitely puts that relationship at the center too. And it's Tom Burke, he's easy to follow as the hero of that.
I mean, he's great eye candy, but as Karen says in the books, it's Beauty and the Beast. And, he's a giant. Quite literally, you know, is what his name means. And, you know, Tom Burke is not even 6 feet tall.
I thought he was 6'2".
No, he's 5'10 on a tall day.
Oh,
he's wearing platform shoes.
Oh, okay.
Maybe.
It's funny. He certainly gives the impression of being taller on the screen. I don't know if it's the camera angles or a bunch of other short actors to stand beside him or
Robin
what.
Robin is a short actress. The actress they have is you know, sort of like my height. She's like 5'6".
Yeah.
So, So
visually, I mean, he looks a lot bigger. I mean, he fills up the room the way they shoot that. So I think visually they're handling that pretty well.
He just does not intimidate other characters the way a man of his girth and insights would do. I have arguments with the TV series, but it's if it brings more readers, bring it on. You know, it's great. But the Tom Burke thing, as Karen says, you don't get some of the key tension in that relationship, which is that he's significantly older. He's more than 10 years older than Robin. He's got tremendous emotional baggage, which makes him, especially the Charlotte thing. On the TV screen, it's like these two are in love from the gun, you know, and there's real magnetism between the two of them. That's not just about vengeance and justice, which is, you know, their driving desire for the truth, which unites them. It's the fact that they seem to have a great chemistry.
I can buy the good-looking Tom Burke in the role, though, because obviously Cormoran Strike is an incredibly attractive man. I mean, he's got these rich supermodel women falling all over with him and sleeping with him in every book. So there's got to be something really, really appealing about him, and if it's not his physical appearance, you know, it's a little hard for me to imagine just exactly what it is. So,
well, it's got to be some kind of charisma. I don't know how a TV show would do that besides the physical appearance. He's a lot rougher in the books. He's rougher looking. He's, you know, he's just a rougher personage. His presentation.
I think the limp on television helps give him that more rough, almost animalistic type of appearance, just because he's limping so often, and he does that pretty well.
Well, I don't like the TV thing for that reason, but what I do like about the books, I agree with Karen, the Strike Robin relationship is what keeps me turning the pages in large part. I just love hearing their conversations. Their playful interactions, but the keeper for me is the narrative release, the Twine stories. I disagree with Louise that we don't really know what the story is about. The story is about Lita's death and Rokeby's involvement in it. Ultimately, Charlotte will get involved with that. Charlotte, the scorned woman, who's a mad woman. She's I won't use the words that they're used to describe her, what Strike's best friend calls her, but she's messed up to the core, as he says. Now that is the most exciting thing to me is watching these things play out. Then you get into the structure of the stories and how Rowling's really her mastery of the thriller whodunit genre, in addition to her craft as a ring writer, this the embedded mythology, which is mind blowing. My only frustration Katie, is with Potter fans who won't read this stuff. I mean, this I really do think this is Rowling's best writing ever, mm-hmm. and there's not that besides the wonderful conversation you can have with Karen and Louise and a few friends. There's just not that intense a conversation about it.
Right. I think you were talking about how, you know, we don't have the same number of conference presentations about Cormoran Strike. We don't have the same attendance at those. People are not making the transition from Harry Potter fans to Cormoran Strike fans. They really are interested in, you know, the wizards, Hogwarts and the London of the magical realm that J.K. Rowling has created, and they're not so willing to make the leap.
And even those of us who are serious Cormoran Strike fans, I count myself as one of those guys. I don't have the command. I've read the books 3, 4, 5 times. I've charted them. I'm pretty serious about this. But this morning I was trying to find the name of the business or the CEO of the business that was going to hire Robin as an embedded, basically spy inside his own business to find out what was going on inside and something was going on he didn't like. And the person basically cancels the contract because of the leg arriving in the beginning of Career of Evil. And I couldn't find it. And I didn't remember it. Now, this is important because we actually have a picture of that office and the CEO and who's a chain of command. I mean, Rowling has given us a big clue that this is going to be an important part of some book, if not Lethal White, then something later on, that this is, this thing that was mentioned is going to play out in a later book. And I couldn't find it. Well,
it's there. I found it the last time I read through there.
Oh yeah. I know it's there. I was disappointed that I couldn't this morning lay my finger on it very quickly, or, this is something I should be able to recall. That's the kind of detail. If you're a Harry Potter fan, you'd know right away. I mean, who was the gamekeeper before Hagrid? It was Og. It's only mentioned once in Goblet of Fire, but most of us, know that stuff. Anyway.
And if you didn't know it, you just ask the question on a forum and you'll get 20 answers because Harry Potter fans love Harry Potter trivia. Mm-hmm.
That's right.
So someone will know, but it does seem weird to be, I mean, there are a lot of readers of these books, but it's like there's a kind of silence about it. It's a bit weird from the fandom. There's this silence from the fandom. They haven't plugged in to these books. So I want to talk about another thing that I dislike. And that is that there are a lot of cardboard 2D characters in these novels. And I get a little tired of that. Like, I feel like the Strike and Robin relationship is developed so carefully and beautifully.
And it's not a cliche either. No, it's an interesting, nuanced kind of relationship.
Very nuanced. Perfect word. But there's so many characters in these books that are just kind of types. Like, especially I noticed in The Cuckoo's Calling, there's all these people who are throwing their money around and they're shallow, and Rowling really dislikes shallow people, which I understand, but I get a little bit bored reading about people that we can't care about.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was reading the New York Times critic Kakutani, who was saying that there's no foe really worthy of Strike and Robin in the sense of like being an intellectual equal or,
he needs a Moriarty.
He needs a Moriarty, exactly. And maybe, Rokeby will turn out to be that. So Kakutani was talking about Voldemort and how, he's a kind of epic villain, world-shattering villain. The fate of the world rests on Harry's shoulders. there's none of that sense of the epic here about the villains. Now, you know, it's very, very important that they stop the serial killer in Career of Evil, because he's literally mutilating women, and he'll keep going unless he stops. But he's really boring in some fundamental way.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. The psychopath thing is almost exhausted, right? And it's like, okay, this guy's nuts. We got it.
Although, I mean, keep in mind, I mean, we've still only seen three books, and, you know, there were some characters in Harry Potter that seemed to be sort of one-note type characters. I'm thinking Arabella Figg. Okay, she was the crazy cat lady in the first book. Well, turns out there's a little bit more to Arabella Figg than meets the eye. Even the Dursleys, I mean, were very one-dimensional in terms of, yes, they're the nasty aunt and uncle. Well, you know, turns out, you know, when Petunia suddenly reveals she knows what Dementors are, and Dudley tells Harry, I don't think you're a waste of space. You know, there's some growth in that. So I think there's certainly room for characters who we may think are one-note, two-dimensional figures now. They may turn out to be more significant than we think.
But Karen's point, though, is well mm-hmm. taken, that we don't have yet the big villain. We meet Voldemort in the first book in the climax, really, in the back of you know, Quildemort's head, but we don't get that with Rokeby. We understand that Strike has met him two times. We don't know what the two times were, and he's a threat in a way in the first book, because he has the note, the loan, and then his agent is harassing Strike, and we get to see his brother, his half brother, in Silkworm Al, and we know he's in the background all the time. Everybody who meets him wants to know about Johnny Rokeby, Johnny Rokeby, Johnny Rokeby. So I think we know who that character is, but Karen's right. Until he comes on stage, the way that Voldemort appears at the end of Goblet, we don't really know what the story's about. We don't have a foil, contrary, a doppelganger that's equal to this character we're getting. But Katie and Louise have pointed out that we're getting, this is three stories in, and we have to really come to sympathy with this pube-headed, peg-legged, beast of an intellect with superpowered memory, and admire him and acknowledge his faults and such, and see him as this agent of vengeance in Strike, and then we get to see Rokeby as his foil. And I think we're being set up for this. But yeah, Karen, I think that's a wonderfully pertinent criticism, that we haven't got a Voldemort yet. I think Lethal White promises to be the reveal.
And I think there's a kind of a, you know, I've realized J.K. Rowling is kind of a misanthrope. You know, she's disappointed in humanity at a basic level, I think. It kind of comes through the Cormoran Strike series, you know, that there are so many of us who, you know, who are not doing the right things, who are petty and vindictive and those kinds of things. And then you get to, I think she does sometimes develop those. I was thinking about when you said that about characters who, you know, really just look very two-dimensional. I was thinking about in The Cuckoo's Calling, there's Tansy, who is portrayed as the society lady. You know, she married for money, and she seems kind of stiff and cold, and you do get to know some of the tragedy of her experience of her life in a way that at least makes you understand where a lot of that is coming from. So maybe there are other characters who are going to be able to see develop or grow. But I find myself agreeing with both Karen and Louise on that one. So,
she's promised us a character. This detective Sergeant Ekwenski is going to be a much bigger role in the coming books.
Oh, cool.
And I think she'll be a much more sympathetic and rich character. That's someone that we can actually like. besides Robin and Cormoran and Robin's mother, who's a very, very nice lady.
I hope we see more of Ciara too. From that she was, you know.
Oh
again,
yeah, the model.
The model, yes. But you know, happened to throw off. Oh yeah, by the way, I've got a place in Oxford waiting for me. You know, I mean, more than a pretty face. I mean, you've got. It's interesting that there does seem to be this very strong, or this very, Rowling clearly values education and values intellect. I mean, she's got Cormoran as being this, you know, guy who left the university for the army, and then you've got Ciara, the model, who is just earning money before she can go to the university. Robin, the university dropout that she very much regrets it and you know, would like to get back and get, you know, resume her education or resume her degree. I think, anyway, I'm hoping we see Ciara again.
She admires intellect, but it's also very important to be grounded and earthy, and I think that's the thing with Strike. I think she didn't want to make Harry Potter really intellectual because she wanted him to be a kind of every child, every boy, who many people would identify with. So Strike is very earthy and real and down to earth. And I mean, there's a lot of times when we see him going to have a pee and having a drink in the bar. And it's like she really hates
The sofa farting whenever he sits on it.
Oh, right.
Pardon?
The sofa that farts every time somebody
sits
on it.
Yeah, that's our comic relief.
Well, if you look at Robin's instruction, you know, she actually hasn't stopped learning. She did the driving course, and Cormoran gets her the, a detective course?
Surveillance course.
And so she is still doing things, right, that are in the realm of education for sure.
She's not going back to school, though. I don't think she has any desire to go back to get her degree. She's got her vocation, and she's pursuing it. If that involves extra training and courses and reading, fine, but she's OJT. She's not going back to school.
OJT.
I don't know.
On the job training.
Psych 3. Sorry.
Louise wants her to finish that degree in psychology, of course.
I got it.
If Louise were her advisor, she would be.
Yes.
Saying, when are you coming back?
She can't be your
academic,
though. Or my old enough
to be her advisor.
Sorry, Karen, what'd you say?
She can't be an academic. Like, that's she's right. Got to be out there in the world doing things. You know, I wonder if this is like a 7, 8, 9 book romance novel that, you know, that has us all fascinated with will they or won't they? And sometimes it seems like the mystery is just kind of the material behind it.
I did sort of feel like that with Career of Evil, because although there is this killer, you know, who is still killing, that does give it a sense of urgency. So much of the novel is Cormoran, like, thinking back on the things, the investigations that he's had before, and the, you know, the kind of things that made him the kind of detective that he is. It's actually a very personal crime novel, which is a really interesting take.
Well, also just that there's a countdown in Career of Evil to the wedding, and you keep thinking, please don't let this wedding happen. I don't know about all of you. I was ready to, you know, burst into the church with Cormoran and have a throwdown with Matt right there. You know,
I mean that was the one of the best moments in the TV series. I realize it doesn't sound like any of you have seen the final episode of that. Oh, well, do you mind if I spoil it?
Spoil it.
Okay, spoil it. Okay. Well, when Shanker's driving him to the wedding, he's making fun of him. He says, "What are you going to do? You're going to rush in and yell at Elaine, Elaine." It's like it's in The Graduate, which was not in the book. I checked.
No.
I thought that was priceless.
Oh, that's funny.
I thought that was, you know, again, that very occasional moment where the TV/movie improves the book, and I think throwing in the Elaine line was great.
You know, and back to Karen's point about the romance aspect, J.K. Rowling is romantic. If you look at the epilogue of the Harry Potter series, that is a romance novel epilogue. You know, that's sort of, you know, tying all the relationships up in a bow to the extent that, you know, they didn't die through the series. And, you know, really trying to give the people who had followed the teenage romances what they wanted in the end. And I think she has a little bit of that romance that... that maybe that's right. Maybe this is a very long, romantic. John, you talk about slow narrative release. Maybe that's what we're doing with the romance in this one. John, another thing that you had talked about that I wanted to get back to was you mentioned the importance of classics and mythology. And, you know, although we've just been talking about how we don't have people who are necessarily academics who are our central characters, nevertheless, Cormoran Strike is definitely very well educated himself in the classics, and we know that J.K. Rowling herself is a classic studies major. We have talked a lot about how you see those images and ideas coming through the Harry Potter series. Where do we see that in the Strike series so far? And I know, John, you've talked about this some, so we'll start with you on this one.
Well, really the authority on this is a woman named Joanne Gray, formerly of Uteronal, I think, that and she's written about this at Hogwarts Professor about Leda and the Swan.
Right.
And there's one place where that I noticed that the TV show has a better line than the books. It's that at one point they're Strike talks about his relationship with his father, and he says, "I was nothing but a shudder in the loins to my father," and that's from a poem by Yeats called Leda and the Swan. I mean, this is not a small, you know, aside. This is a big pointer. And for those people who don't know about Leda and the Swan, Leda is the queen of Sparta, and she has twin sets with Zeus and the king of Sparta, Tyndareus. Louise will have to explain the genetics there. It's how you can have, you know, two sets of twins, male and female, where one father is the father of one daughter and the other of the other daughter, and same thing with the boys. And Leda has Helen of Troy, Zeus is the father, and Clytemnestra is Tyndareus' daughter. But the big set are Pollux and Castor, or Castor and Pollux usually. Pollux is, or Polyduces, the very sweet one, is a boxer. And Castor is the master of horses. We know that really Leda and the Swan, if translated into modern terms, is really like a groupie and a rock star. You know, that this the equivalent of a human being and a god is equivalent of the super fan, super groupie, and a Mick Jagger stand-in. And that's what we have here with Leda Strike and Johnny Rokeby. This plays out not only because Strike is a boxer, but we have Shanker, who is really his doppelganger twin, and his relationship and Shanker's relationship with Leda as his second mother, and sort of the unnatural relationship with Leda Strike and their twin desire to find out who murdered her, and both of them being separated from, you know, the seeming father, Whitaker, when in fact the Tyndareus character, it's really Zeus, the ropey character, that's just like the Orestes mythology is behind Harry Potter. You know, where else do you find a guy with a lightning shaped scar on his forehead but Orestes? So Castor and Pollux and Leda and the Swan informs this story. And again, this is all Joanne Gray. This is not, you know, John's great insights. There's other stuff here about the three fates we've seen from the Twitter header, and just like we had the weird sisters appear in Goblet of Fire, we're going to see the three fates and some shadow of that probably in the next book, especially with Charlotte Campbell. We see a lot of crows, and that's the Campbells have a relationship with the crows. And mythology, we've got Dido and the Aeneid. You know, this returning soldier coming back from the wars, who's fated to be this way. We have a lot of thing about his being cursed, fate, and a betrayed woman, where really Charlotte Campbell is the Dido figure of this thing and the harpy. So there's a lot of action like that going on inside the story that there's a mythic element. It's very realistic. It's very gritty. But right beneath the surface, she's giving this a superhuman, mythological, godlike note that's being sounded, where he's an agent of vengeance and he's a pursuer of justice. He's something much larger than life. He has a divine vocation to be this agency for what's right in the world. And Robin responds to that. Robin wants to be, you know, really his, I don't know if his Watson of sorts, because she shares that same kind of desire to set things right and to figure things out. But anyway, without that backdrop, I mean, Rowling is not a classics major the way we describe that in the United States. I mean, she did not study Latin and Greek. She studied mythology, and she said in her what was the name of that nymph anyway essay she wrote for the University of Exeter Alumni Magazine. You know, she has more books on mythology now than she did when she was in school. I mean, she's really consumed by mythology. We see the same thing in the Fantastic Beasts series and how the mythology is playing out there, but it largely to do with the Theseus story. But here it's Leda and the Swan and the two brothers of Leda, the two sons of Leda, Pollux and Castor. All right.
That is really interesting. Okay, I tell you what I love, and that was so much there that it's going to take me a little while to digest it, but I think, so much new there. One of the things that I love here is her thinking about mythology and that whole intersecting of the world of the gods and the world of humanity, and trying to articulate that in the modern world as that realm of celebrity with Absolutely. The people who are underneath that realm. And Cormoran is kind of in between in that way that somebody who was maybe, you know, the son of a god, right, of a god-human mix might inhabit that realm. And if you look at all of the books, Cuckoo's Calling is about Supermodel and that whole rarefied world that she lives in. The Silkworm is the publishing industry and a kind of celebrity world that develops there. And Career of Evil, I think really interestingly, is about Cormoran Strike's celebrity and maybe even Robin. I mean, Robin is protected from, you know, being made a public figure to a significant degree, but that there is that kind of questioning of, you know, the realm of the gods and what's happening there and how's that intersecting with the realm of humanity. That does seem to be a theme that's playing out through all the three that we've seen so far.
What's really fun about the mythological stuff is once you see it, then you find things like Castor is the breaker of horses, and Pollux has nothing to do with horses. He's the boxer, and so Robin, she rode horses, and Cormoran likes to tease her about it. He never gets on a horse. He doesn't like horses, doesn't trust horses. And so if you know the Castor and Pollux mythology, you're laughing, saying, okay, of course he doesn't. He's not Castor. He's Pollux. And when Shankar appears, he doesn't arrive on a horse, but he's quite clearly the contrary, really almost the absolute inversion. He always talks about his life taking the opposite path, and yet they're conjoined in a way. And when Robin uses Shankar to do very much what Strike had done in Cyprus as a soldier by breaking into a house to rescue this woman and her baby,
she's twinning them intentionally.
That's right. That's right. And we get, then of course, Cormoran uses Shankar almost in the exact same fashion to bring down the strangler, you know, the psychopathic killer and career. So they're reconciled almost in that twinning, and so then he can go to the wedding. Having reconciled in a way with her by having followed her lead. The mythological backdrop for Rowling is essential for understanding the depth of what she's after.
And I think that's that parallels very nicely with the Harry Potter thing too, in terms of Harry being caught between these two worlds of the Muggles and the wizarding, and how he belongs to this wizarding world, yet he's been stuck in the Muggle world most of his life, and his transition between the two worlds is a nice parallel there. Getting back to Harry.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, this kind of leads us into our another question about how the Harry Potter books and the Strike series parallel each other. We've talked about some of them, some of those connections already. Of course, they're coming from the same author, and her mind works in a certain way, and so we can expect there to be some commonalities there. But I know, John, you in particular, and Louise, I think you have also said this too, that there are specific parallels between the book ones, the book twos, and the book threes of each series so far. And I thought this is one of the things that I was very skeptical about. I read The Cuckoo's Calling, and I was like, I don't see the Sorcerer's Stone in this until I actually was reading some about it. So I wonder if for our listeners who remain skeptical, you know, what's the evidence that these parallels exist? Let's just draw out. What are some of the parallels between the book ones, the book twos, and the book threes?
The first book correspondences are that they're orphan stories. You know, you got Harry, Lula, and Cormoran here. I mean, and the drama is about these orphan children and how they're adopted and how they make their way. And at the end, I Am Become a Name is, you know, where we get Tennyson's Ulysses, though it's a misuse. I mean, I Am Become a Name in Tennyson is I Have Become a Cliche, but here it's I Have Become a Name. I Have Become a Man Who Stands on His Own Merits Rather Than His Family. So that Harry Potter at the end of Philosopher's Stone has become, you know, a hero in his own right, not just a guy who survived being murdered by the Dark Lord. And Cormoran has stepped out from being just Johnny Rokeby's son. You know, he's known as for who he is now. He's solved a case. There's huge Easter echoes in the first two books. I mean, Harry rises from the dead after 3 days in the hospital wing, and in Cormoran Strike, he doesn't rise from the dead after 3 days. But the central event of the story, the first murder that the criminal commits, happens on Easter weekend, and everything radiates out from that. But really, most important, I think, is that the story, you know, The Cuckoo's Calling story, is much less important than the introduction of the hero and the overarching questions, all the mysteries that we're about to get. And this is really the heart of this theory, is that Rowling wrote under a pseudonym because she wanted to write basically a commentary on the first book and to show what was really important about her work. And she didn't want to do that under her own name because it would be an obvious exercise, you know, almost a narcissistic endeavor. Even though people like, Vladimir Nabokov, he wrote this huge academic translation and commentary on, famous Russian poet and poem, and then wrote Pale Fire, and it has an exact corresponding, you know, parts in the book as his own academic work. I mean, this kind of self-parody and self-consciousness is not a sign of a narrow-minded, self-consumed author, but of someone who really is trying to express a fuller understanding of her own work.
That's a really great idea. So it's not just that we're seeing parallels in the way that she lays out the stories and sort of her idea of how you what do you do in a first book in a series, that kind of thing, but it's actually, she is using the Cormoran Strike series as an adult real world commentary on the books, the Harry Potter books themselves. So it's her way of going back into them and, as you said, emphasizing the things that she thinks we should have been getting in book one of Harry Potter to begin with.
I think so.
Well, what about, so book two, we've got the Gilderoy Lockhart at the center, and then we also have narcissistic authors at the center of book two. I don't know if Karen or Louise, do you have more specific things that you would point out that are connections between those two books?
I was a bit skeptical. I mean, knowing John as long as I have, I knew as soon as I heard this book existed, I knew he was going to be looking for Harry Potter parallels, and he would have found them had Robin and Cormoran been sitting there watching bananas turn brown for the entire time. He would have found some parallel with Harry Potter. Also Christian imagery and ring theory and literary alchemy.
So, Louise, what do you see as, you say you're somewhat skeptical about these connections. When did you start to see, or what brought you around to the idea that there are, you know, these common elements, especially in the book twos?
Well, it was really when John pointed out that the entire second book centers on a mystery that's about another book, that just like Chamber of Secrets centered on the mystery that was Tom Riddle's diary. And of course, Tom Riddle's diary turns out not to be just a diary, but a horcrux, and that whole thing picks up later in the series.
And it's deceptive. But in particular, it's a deceptive book.
In particular, I mean, it was a diary, which means it's an autobiographical book, and it was used as revenge, or as used as this plot to kill and purge. I mean, you know, exactly as the
Bombyx Mori
was used as a, you know, a book within a book that is basically the weapon. It's the weapon that is used as the center of the murder.
But it's not the plot of Tom Riddle's diary. There is no plot in Tom Riddle's diary. It's blank, and he writes things in it to talk to Harry.
Yes, but he sealed his own memory in it. The way he describes it is I put my, of course, we later know it's his soul. I mean, talk about pouring your soul into the book. That certainly comes up in Bombyx Mori. But he said, you know, he describes it as a memory. You know, I'm a memory that came from the book that I sealed in here when I was 16 years old. So, yeah, no, it was not a story, although he does, you know, Harry goes into the diary and hears the story about how the Chamber of Secrets was first opened, and how Hagrid was, I mean, it was a false story. It was the false story of how Hagrid opened the chamber, where it turns out it was someone getting framed for murder. But I think there are a lot of, yeah, the fact that the diary itself does not have a plot, it still tells a story. I mean, it tells the story of what happened 50 years ago.
There's a woman named Patricia Baker who has posted about this at Hogwarts Professor. I'm just going to read some of the things that she came up with. You know, in both books, someone sneaks a false book to others in order to cause harm. Although people try to hide and destroy this book, it's impossible to eradicate. The last time each author had influence, a young woman died. The protagonist defends a person who loves and cares for someone who is unpredictable and feared or voted by most people, Hagrid, Aragog, Leonora, Orlando. People are struggling to determine whether they will be who others say they are, who they themselves choose to be, Harry and Robin. Harry and Cormoran both struggle with how to respond to having famous parents and being well-known as a result of events they did not cause. Then there's Ron and Harry hit the Whomping Willow and are found out for taking the Fort Anglia. Robin and Cormoran also hit a tanker and are found out when Robin remarks on a newspaper article about the accident. Hogwarts students find petrified classmates with messages written on the walls near them. Cormoran finds Owen in a setting that has been staged to point people to the false book. Michael Fancourt seems like a muggle version of Gilderoy Lockhart. Tom Riddle uses an accomplice who does not fully understand the impact of what she is doing, Ginny, to release the Basilisk. Liz Tassel uses an accomplice who does not fully understand the impact of what he is doing, Owen, to release and publicize the false Bombyx Mori. In Chamber, Harry summons Gilderoy Lockhart to help him face the Basilisk. In Silkworm, Cormoran summons Michael Fancourt to draw out Liz Tassel. And this goes on. I mean, near the end of Chamber, the villain is trying to kill red-haired Ginny. Near the end of Silkworm, the villain is trying to kill red-haired Robin. I mean, this goes on and on. This is a pretty stunning set of parallels inside these things. Now, yeah, you can say, you know, John's just projecting these similarities, but I think, you know, this book within a book and really Beatrice Groves' work on this and the actual embedded text inside of this, the poetry that's inside of the silkworm, really draws this out. That this is the most, Silkworm is the most literary novel of anything that Rowling has ever written about the reading experience. And her books are largely about reading books. And so Silkworm is the most important. But it points back to how we're supposed to understand Chamber of Secrets as just that kind of story about how to read a book.
And I wonder what we would say about book three. I remember, John, you telling me before I read book three, you were like, book three is as different from books one and two as The Prisoner of Azkaban was from the first two books in the Harry Potter series. What would you see as the parallels between the book threes?
Well, the big thing here is the big backstory drop. You know, we get the Shrieking Shack reveal with Robin, Shanker, Leda, information dumps. We get all of Cormoran's, you know, background about the three characters that he believes, you know, could have been the person that sent the leg to Robin. We get the Shanker story and really much more information about Leda's death. And of course, we get the Robin, you know, why Robin left the university. I want to spoil that for everybody. But just like in Prisoner of Azkaban, all of a sudden the story, you know, we thought we had sort of a three-dimensional fun story, but no, we didn't have more than a one-dimensional story until Prisoner of Azkaban. And just like the Time Turner explodes the idea of time, we explode the idea of story inside of Prisoner of Azkaban. The same thing happens there. I mean, Robin seems to be haunted almost by Dementors in the book. Cormoran's using a memory Time Turner of sorts. I would say, though, that this book is such a departure that it's an Ian Rankin novel. It's more like Ian Rankin's Black and Blue with all the rock and roll references than Prisoner of Azkaban even. But it's not a P.D. James novel. It's an Ian Rankin thriller. But it's so very different, and yet it gives us that big backstory drop that Prisoner of Azkaban featured.
Well, I mean, the other part of it, of course, is that we spend most of Prisoner of Azkaban, you know, thinking an escaped convict is out there trying to kill Harry. We spend most of Queer of Evil knowing that a criminal is out there trying to kill Robin. Hmm. And interestingly, it's sort of an inversion. I mean, two of the three suspects are not, you know, wrongfully convicted criminals who have escaped. They are people that Strike thinks should have gone to prison but got off. Hmm. So you've got, you know, the reversal there. And of course, the killer doesn't turn out to be either of those two guys. Does turn out to be the guy who actually went to prison. But you've got that whole idea of, you know, who goes to jail, who does not. And you've got this, the protagonists being stalked, or at least we think being stalked by a criminal for most of the book. So we also, of course, the other similarity I see there is, you know, just like Harry had to make the decision at the end of Prisoner of Azkaban to let Peter Pettigrew go free if he wants to save Buckbeak and Sirius from their from dying as innocent of criminals, Robin had to choose to let Brockback get away in order to save the child, Alyssa's child, from the sexual abuse that she was experiencing. So
what's the payoff?
That choice at the end.
I'm kind of wondering what the payoff is. Like, there are various correspondences, there are some similarities, but I just don't think it's central to the Strike series. Like, I really feel it's going on its own path. I just don't see that it helps us all that much to see correspondences. It's interesting for us as Harry Potter fans, but
you don't think
I don't
it really
think it reveals that
anything
much to us.
Oh, okay.
No.
Well,
yeah.
There's. I mean, I wrote in February that pretty much just what Karen said, that while this theory has my name all over it, if you follow it around, it's especially because we don't know if it's a seven book series or not. the value of it is very questionable. I mean, we were told at the very beginning in the first stories about Rowling being Galbraith that it was a 7-book series. Rowling and her publishers immediately denied it. She denied it was even going to be a series. Now we were up to 14 or 15 books in the series in terms of what she's told Tom Burke. So we have no idea whether it's a 7-book series or not. We don't know if Rowling's lying or deceiving or what it is. We do seem to see a 7-book story arc coming out. And in that respect, the correspondences are very interesting. But until we know really what the first 7 books will look like, this is all a curious exercise in close reading. It does help us if we, for example, we know that the 4th book will feature the poetry of Catullus. She's already quoted Catullus on her Twitter feed. We've seen pictures of the poetry of Catullus also on her Twitter feed as something that she's got at her desk while she's writing. And the 1st book, all of the epigraphs that she starts chapters with were classical references. We know that the poetry of Catullus is Strike's favorite book. He quotes Catullus at great length to Michael Fancourt in The Silkworm. So we're seeing a correspondence between 1 and 4 already in terms of the epigraphs. For people who don't know this, the epigraphs in the 1st book, which was calling are classical. In the 2nd book, they're taken from Jacobean revenge drama. And then the 3rd book is all Blue Oyster Cult things. Again, much like Ian Rankin's quoting of Rolling Stones and Black and Blue. But the 4th book, we can be pretty sure is going to be filled with classical references, like the 1st book would suggest a 1-4-7 story arc, much as we saw in Harry Potter. I'm with Karen in saying, hold this theory at arm's length. Mm. It's not your secret key that tells you what's going to happen and what it really means. But I do think if you're a serious reader of Harry Potter, it helps to note these references and to think what is Rowling saying is the most important aspect of her artistry that she's trying to highlight in both books.
It does give us something to try to predict with, right? As we look forward to book 4, what are some things we might expect if we think we might see some things that connect up with book 4, Goblet of Fire? That might be a little tricky, but we also now have the back of the book synopsis for Lethal White coming out. So if we're looking at the back of the book synopsis, what tidbits did we get there? What are the things that we think we're going to see now? Karen, I think you have some musings on what we might expect here.
Well, I guess the only thing I really know for sure is about Strike and Robin, that they will continue to feel attracted to each other, and this is really going to mess up the relationship between Robin and Matthew. But I don't know what's going to happen with that, how long that will take. Like, is that going to come to a head in book 4? I'm not sure. But I was interested to see that the part of the plot of Career of Evil is just our fear that something's going to happen to Robin, that she's going to be attacked by the serial killer because we know he's stalking her. And then Strike is terribly upset with himself that he let this happen to Robin, even though it wasn't his fault. But so you can tell that they're getting more and more interested in each other. The thing that makes Robin happiest at the wedding is that Strike showed up and that their friendship is not completely on the rocks. So I see that being huge. It's the next book is supposed to pick up right from where the last left off. Matthew is going to have a complete shit fit about Carmen Strike.
That's the technical term.
That's right.
The psychological
wedding.
That's right.
Term. That's yeah, right. And the Sakari window.
I was thinking one challenge is that for Strike to be really heroic in a kind of Harry Potter sense, he would have to save Robin from some major event, some major danger. But what I loved in Career of Evil is that she saves herself.
Absolutely.
That was, for me, a huge triumph. An amazing, wonderful development in Career of Evil, that instead of the princess being rescued by the knight, the princess rescues herself from the evil serial killer. And like, for them to be good partners, she has to be a kind of equal, and she has to go into danger with him. So it's kind of, it'll be interesting to see how does the romance plot kind of mesh with the detective plot. How are they going to do that? So that, I'm kind of intrigued about that, because I know that they're headed, I am sure they are headed for marriage at the very end of the series.
Whew. Oh, you're confident. I like that.
I am confident.
Well,
yes.
And it does, the synopsis ends with a statement about the relationship between Robin and Cormoran Strike. So the last line is, plus, his relationship with his former assistant is more fraught than it has ever been. Robin is now invaluable to Strike in the business, but their personal relationship is much, much more tricky than that. So that's the note it ends on. Like, that's the thing that's supposed to make you grab the book and go to the cash register. Right, so she's definitely using that as a way to pull us through the series, I think.
I think so, yes.
Yeah, so how about Louise or John? What do you all think of the synopsis here? What might we expect as the story picks up?
Well, what intrigued me was the mystery aspect of it, that apparently starts with this boy coming into this Strike's office and describing a murder he believes he witnessed as a child, and the line they use is, it was strangled up by the horse. Of course, I'm sure we'll get to Lethal White and what that title has to do with horses in a few minutes, but you know, first of all, the idea of exploring a mystery through human memory, of course, again, here's the psychologist in me finding that very fascinating. I think that's a nice, again, a potential parallel with Harry Potter, since the Goblet of Fire is when the Pensieve was introduced, this highly accurate, you know, magical dip into your memories, as opposed to our own muggle human fallible memories, and sounds like a kid who is not going to be sure whether his memories are real or not. Mm-hmm. You know, the other way, what it makes me think of when they, the way it was phrased, you know, it was, he strangled it up by the horse. It, that makes me think that the victim is either a newborn baby or a fetus. That's the human most likely to be referred to as that it, rather than a he or a she. So I don't know if we're looking at, you know, an old murder of a baby, which would certainly be interesting. Makes, of course, you, again, may bring us back to what happened with Charlotte, and you know, did she miscarry or abort, you know, Cormoran's child back before the series began. That may twist that around. And
of course, let's talk about the Lethal White title. Lethal White does have a connection with horses, right?
Yes, and we've certainly seen pictures of white horses all over J.K. Rowling's social media. But yes, Lethal White is a genetic condition that is carried by American paint horses, I believe it is. And it results in, if you're trying to breed this particular types of horses, sometimes you get a horse that's inherited two copies of this particular gene that is a lethal condition, and the horse will basically die within a couple of days of birth. Again, they strangled it up by the horse. This idea of a newborn dying.
And of course, the question is, Beatrice Groves, I think, brought this up first, that horse can just be a dialect. The boy was trying to say house up by the horse. And so there's this play, because it's also a type of deadly heroin. We know it's going to be central to how this plays out, because Lita Strike dies of a heroin overdose. We're going to learn about what really happened here. So it's back and forth. And of course, the boy says, I saw a murder up by the horse. Is that a name for the house? Because we find out also in that back of the book blurb that we're going to go to a manor house out in the country. We're going to basically see a P.D. James novel, what they used to call a cozy detective thing. Now this is important. The P.D. James connection is huge. Since we've last talked, believe it or not, I have read the complete P.D. James. That's 17 novels.
Goodness, John.
And if you want to understand how important this is, I mean, just from like the first seven or eight books, here are some names that appear. There's Felix, there's Arabella, who was a cat murdered exactly in a fashion suggestive of the petrification chamber. There's Pettigrew, that James talks about, a solicitor who was cursed with a name like that, really highlights the name. There's Morag, there's Orlando, a child who died young. There's Rose, there's a McGonagall, referenced to as the poet as arguably Britain's worst poet ever, which Rowling references exactly that reference. There's Remus, who is a dog. There's Peveril, the family, and it's exactly that kind of family reference like we get in the Peveril story. There's Wardle, who's a police surgeon in Original Sin. There's a Venetia in A Certain Justice. I mean, P.D. James, if nothing else, is the one-stop source for rolling names in Harry Potter and
Cormoran
Strike.
She's been reading a lot of P.D. James.
P.D. James is huge for understanding Rowling as a writer in general, but especially Rowling as a mystery thriller writer. And the manor house, the single place, just like we saw in Cuckoo's Calling, it was her apartment. And we had the same sort of situation in the house where Owen Quine is murdered in The Silkworm. And much less so, but we get Donnie Lang's apartment where the psychopath is hiding out with all of his body pieces in the last one. But here we're promised a manor house out in the country. That is a straight P.D. James connection. We're going to see the heavy influence of P.D. James in that.
Oh,
and of course, a manor house out in the country is where Goblet of Fire began and ended.
Exactly.
Too.
Very good. And I think, Louise, you had also mentioned that one of the things that you can see is she's using the major events of 2011 as the backdrop. So last time it was the marriage of William and Kate Middleton, and the marriage of Robin and Matthew was sort of happening, you know, about the same time. And I think, Louise, that you suggested that 2011 might have an Olympics connection.
Well, that was much earlier. I thought that it would make a lot of sense in the light of Goblet of Fire being this great athletic oriented book to have the Olympics be the backdrop of the fourth Cormoran Strike book. Although if it does in fact pick up at the wedding, it's going to have to jump ahead about a year in order for that to happen, because so that's looking maybe a little less likely. Although, interestingly enough, Robin noticed the Olympic Stadium being built in Career of Evil, and so
we've had
that's
a hint
very
about
J.K.
it.
Rowling thing to do is to notice the Olympic Stadium in one book and then bring up the Olympic Stadium later. Again, maybe if this is not a seven series book, maybe that will happen future.
Well, we do know if this book starts right at the end of the wedding, that it starts on 2 July 2011. And we know from strikefans.com that the first three novels were about 1 month, 1 month, and 2.5 months in duration. So we're basically looking at July, maybe August 2011 for this book to play out. If you look at news highlights in the UK for July and August of 2011, News of the World goes out of business because their reporters had hacked into phones of celebrities. And Rowling gave testimony that month in the Levinson inquiries just about this. I mean, she is really upset about phone hacking, and Dominic Culpepper is going to be out of a job in book four. Melanie Telford, who's mentioned as a journalist in Cuckoo's Calling, I'm pretty sure she's going to come back into this story as kind of the Rita Skeeter, or something to do with the Levinson inquiry. But the big news is that there were riots in London mm-hmm. in August of 2011 in Tottenham. And I mean, this is a huge thing. I mean, people die, thousands are arrested, millions of pounds of damage are done. It starts in the Tottenham part of London. It's going to be really hard for her not to mention this, right? I mean, if and London is a character in the books, and this character is having a seizure, we're probably going to you know, have some awareness of that.
Yeah, and she's so class oriented. She's very interested in, you know, questions of social class, especially in the very tight world of London, and that's a lot of what those riots were about. So I agree with you. That seems like that's rich material for her to delve into in this fourth book.
But here's my question. I'm especially interested in what Karen thinks about this. Is that the last Harry Potter film, Deathly Hallows Part 2, released in London on 15 July, breaking all box office records for day of release? Is she obliged or free at last to finally talk about Harry Potter inside these books? I mean, there's been no mention of Harry Potter inside any of these books.
Well, there was a mention of Emma Watson's picture on the front of a magazine.
Okay.
At one point.
Well spotted,
Louise. Well spotted.
Okay, I'm going to make a prediction. She is not going to mention the Harry Potter books.
Okay.
At all. It's not... Not at all.
Nothing.
It would seem, it would draw too much attention. It would take people out of the novel world. It would also seem too much like her own product placement. Not that she needs more publicity for the Harry Potter books. It would just seem really, the kind of thing she hates, which is like shameless self-promotion. So I really think she's going to avoid it like the plague.
Well, she is, for her self-promotion is all to do with raising money for Lumos and the Vallant charities. And if you read her Twitter feed every day as I do, you'll see that she's more than happy to just load that Twitter feed up with every possible reference to cursed child openings, movie references, contests. I mean, she does as much Trump bashing as she does a lot more promotion of those things, because those are the things that make money for her charities. But I see your point. These books have been Harry Potter free. I mean, there's one point in the first book where the murderer tells Strike, "You should be a writer of fantasy fiction."
Yes,
okay. But that's about as close as we get, other than a mention of Emma Watson.
Okay, well, maybe she'll do something subtle. We'll be on the lookout. But that's interesting. Well, I wanted to just briefly talk about the Latin quote that she sent out when somebody asked for a teaser for Lethal White, because she quoted. And you've been pronouncing it Catullus, right? Is it Catullus?
Catullus.
And the quote is "Odi et amo," but I'm not going to read the rest of it in Latin. "I hate and love. Why I do so, perhaps you ask. I know not, but I feel it, and I am in torment." And B. Groves on MuggleNet has a full dissection of this quote and what it might mean for book four of the series. And I want to point our listeners in that direction. But I think in short, maybe, John, I think this might be something that you would agree with, it. Maybe we're going to get more Charlotte Cormorant's ex-girlfriend. Really a lot of what that's all about.
Yeah, you mentioned predictions earlier, and we've been taunted throughout the series about Charlotte Campbell, and that he's got this latent virus that he dreads, that he knows it's in there. His love for Charlotte Campbell is in the basement doing push-ups, getting stronger, waiting for the day when that love is going to come upstairs again. This we're almost guaranteed a return of Charlotte Campbell, I think, in this book, especially as a playoff to the first book and how that's where they broke up. Just as I'm pretty sure we're going to see an appearance of Johnny Rokeby in a revelation about Lita's death, Odietta Moe is going to be about his love-hate relationship with Charlotte and the depth of his love for his mother and how much he hates and is going to avenge her death and the point of the coming stories that we're going to have with the reappearance of the Dark Lord. Those are the things that I really think are going to happen. And the Odietta Moe, that sums it up wonderfully. It's a love-hate thing, but that's mostly about Charlotte. It has to be, doesn't it? I mean, that's...
Well, I mean, else? There's Robin and Matthew. I don't know.
I got
well,
you.
No, you think it's Charlotte.
It describes Robin's relationship with Matthew, too, right? I mean, she just...
Well, I don't know. I think it's Charlotte and Strike because the dynamic between Robin and Matthew seems really different. Like, Charlotte is a walking disaster.
There's a lot of drama
Matthew's
there.
It's not, but Strike can't understand why he so loves Charlotte except that she's stunningly beautiful. But so I think because he loves her and he hates her and she loves him and she hates him.
He definitely seems tormented. He's definitely, yeah.
Whereas with Robin and Matthew, she's just wondering, is this the right fit for me? Mm-hmm. But even asking that question means it sort of is and it sort of isn't. Where with Charlotte, the whole thing was a crisis after like the first few minutes of Bliss.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that it's likely that that's what's going to come up again, as John suggested.
Okay. Well, let's just go to our last question here. We are very far out of time, but this has been such an interesting conversation. I feel like I've learned a lot. Let me just ask you all, what are your hopes for the future of this particular series in particular, and J.K. Rowling's novel writing in particular. So, Karen, what do you think? What are you hoping for in the end? I guess I can see you're hoping for Robin Strike romance to develop, but what else
would
you say?
I don't mind whether they get married or they're just really good friends. Either one is fine with me. I want to see them continue to develop their relationship. It's so wonderful to have like an adult relationship that's about caring and loyalty and friendship and intellect and a shared mission and all that stuff. Like if you think about Harry and Ginny, that was kind of a dull relationship.
Oh man!
Narratively speaking, but this is fascinating. So I want it to keep being fascinating.
Uh-huh.
I think I'd be interested to see Rowling one day write a book where she wasn't so tied in by genre. Although she likes it, she likes the confines of the mystery genre. She likes writing two-dimensional characters and kind of using them to sound off on her various pet peeves. But I would like to see her write a book where she could just be a bit more free to go wherever she wanted to go.
Huh.
But whatever she writes, even if it's the phone book, I will be reading it.
I'm with you, Karen. Louise, what about you? What are you looking for in the future?
Well, I like Karen, I'm interested in seeing the Robin and Cormoran relationship play out. It was interesting at the beginning, I was really hoping for the friendship, actually, sort of the Harry, Hermione, she's like a sister to me,
mm-hmm.
friendship, because I really love those in books, and I don't think we see enough of them. However, as Matthew has gotten ever so more loathsome as the series progresses, I'm now warming to the idea of Cormoran and Robin becoming a eventually. What would be interesting to me, and would be interesting to see if this can happen in this very real world setting, is if Rowling does her classic, you know, someone who we really think is bad turns out to be good thing by the end of the series. And I don't know. I don't know who that could be or if that is even feasible. You know, will you know, when Cormoran and Robin welcome their first child, will they be christening it Whitaker or Rokeby or Matthew or something like that? I don't know.
Oh my gosh, not Whitaker. Oh my gosh.
Whitaker. Oh, would that be a yes, Rokeby Whitaker strike? I baptize you.
Oh my gosh.
No, sorry. That would be that. I'm not making that an official prediction.
Okay.
But anyway, so that would be, of course, an interesting twist that I think we will see at some point in some at some level. I don't know that it's a true Rowling series without that type of twist. What I want to see at some point, we've got to get Robin back in that green dress. I don't know if that will actually be her wedding gown or something like that, but that beautiful green dress from the first book, I think that has to make a reappearance at some point. Maybe she and Cormoran will get to go to a Yule Ball type event where she'll get to wear that. I'd like to, you know, in my last rereading of the first three, one thing that struck me is how many names Cormoran Strike has in terms of nobody calls him Cormoran except Robin. I mean, his sister calls him Stick. He's called Mystic Bob. He's called Bunsen. He's called
Monkey Boy,
Bluey. All these different names. I mean, even the person on the street, they assume his name's Cameron. You know, he never gets to use his own name. So I think there's something about identity, about, you know, who am I? That ultimate question that, you know, every protagonist has to answer initially. I think that will be played out, and hopefully by the end, people will be actually calling him Cormoran. So here is, and anyway, that would be, I think, the happy ending for him. As far as other things, what I would like to see from J.K. Rowling, well, you know, I really don't think I can come up with any better ideas than she can. I would not have guessed mystery about a disabled war vet and a hot redhead psychologist. Would not have been my guess for her next series. I will be more than satisfied if she continues to put out strike books and if she continues to write Fantastic Beast scripts on a reasonable schedule. Please don't make us wait 3 years for the next strike book. What I would ask, however, if whatever else she is going to write, please make it a series. Don't try to jam it all in one book like Casual Vacancy. It was just too much. I think Casual Vacancy would have appealed to people much more if it had been like a 2-3-5 book series and told the whole story then, rather than trying to jam it all into one huge volume that was just so dense. Now, should Rowling revisit the Wizarding World, the two things I would like to see most there, I'd like to see Neville Longbottom in the Hogwarts Resistance. I'd like to see Deathly Hallows from his perspective and find out what was going on at Hogwarts that year that Harry and Ron and Hermione were running around in the tent. And then the second thing I'd like to see is the first generation Order of the Phoenix story. You know, what happened in the first Wizarding War. I mean, you could bring in the Marauders. I've said this before, but you know, one character I'd really like to see more of, Arabella Figg. You know, what was a squib doing in the original Order of the Phoenix? You know, she was one of the old crowd. I think there's some... I'd like to see James and Lily and the Longbottoms thrice defying Voldemort. that whole type of stuff. That's if she's going to go back and do more, those are the stories I want to see.
You could always write some fan fiction.
I've been there, done that with not with Harry, with that. That was back in my comic book days. I think I've retired from that. It may still be out there. Who knows?
That's the appeal of the fan fiction, though, right? You can sort of imagine what you wish she would write about.
Oh yeah. But I'm just not creative enough to think of it at this point.
I'd like to add that I'd like to hear about the explosion where Strike lost his leg.
There you go.
There's something going on there.
I bet we'll hear more about that.
I think that's actually, part of Ropey's attempt to kill him.
It's interesting, part of the clues I'm getting of what might be important, of course, what makes it into the TV show. The kid who had a chance to shoot him there and didn't made it into the TV show. So I have a funny idea that something important will come up on that front. John, I hate to tell you this, but what didn't make it into the last TV series, Career of Eagles, the roses and the card and the unread card. They didn't make it into the TV series. So
What Louise is referring to is that a huge bouquet of roses is delivered to Robin's desk, and there was a mystery. Who were they from? The speculation, from me largely, has been that it was from Charlotte to Cormoran rather than from Matt to Robin, and that this was going to be a matter of confrontation. Maybe it was from Ellen Toft, who knows? But that's interesting that did not make it. But yeah,
they didn't make it to the TV. So
there's a moment in the Silkworm where Strike has a memory that flees away from him. It's one of the only times his memory does not give him what he wants. And it's a moment pretty much like the gleam in Dumbledore's eye in Goblet of Fire, that there's a clue there about something that is to play a large part in the whole series. And so I'm looking forward to learning what that was. It's something about the skeleton. And it talks about a minnow escaping through the weeds of his mind there. I look forward to more Cormoran Strike things. I look forward to how the Fantastic Beasts screenplays play out. Though really the whole Warner Brothers thing makes that, and the crowd fascination with Fantastic Beasts rather than Cormoran Strike. I guess just my contrary nature. I'd prefer people were reading it, talking about the books rather than screenplays that we're never going to get an actual rolling draft of uncorrected. I do want to mention one thing that we know from that book blurb, that we didn't discuss. And that's, she talks about a secret part of Parliament in it. Mm. And I think we know from the Twitter heading, B. Groves talked about this at Hogwarts Professor, that there's a chapel, the St. Mary Undercraft Chapel in the Houses of Parliament. Apparently Oliver Cromwell used it to put his horses in there. It's been used as a drinking place, but now it's a place where that their marriages and things are held there, that maybe Charlotte will meet him there. It's in the St. Mary Undercroft Chapel. Anyway, I'm just more excited about more rolling. This is for rolling fans, rolling readers, rolling Potter pundits and such. This is really the most exciting time since the lead up to Deathly Hallows. We're buried in rolling stuff. We're rolling in it, right? And this is great news. This is great news. I mean, rolling is not only responsible for really setting the bar of imaginative experience and what readers expect from great stories in the 21st century, but she's delivering on it in film. She's delivering on it on the printed page. She's really as eccentric and, wild a person as she is. None of us know her really, but who she really is about. As an artist, she's developing and delivering on her potential, I think. And it's very exciting to see as a reader.
Absolutely. I totally agree. It's just so much, there's so much coming out, so much new stuff to talk about, and Cormoran Strike certainly at the top of the list, especially as we eagerly await that book 4 coming out. Well, thank you to our guests, Louise Freeman and Karen Kabarley, for such a great conversation. I really feel like you have helped me to think through some things in the Cormoran Strike series that I hadn't fully thought about yet. Thanks also to you, John Granger, for being our continuing expert guest. And listeners, be on the alert for signups for Wizard Reading Formula coming soon. Big thanks to our technical editor in Australia, Emma Nicholson. Thank you, Emma. We really appreciate all that you do for us. And of course, our partners at MuggleNet, the number one Harry Potter fan site, which also has lots of Cormoran Strike news on it as well. We really appreciate them serving as a platform for our podcast. Thank you very much, MuggleNet. Listeners, we are so glad that you joined us, and we would love it if you would leave a comment or a question for us. Now, I'm going to pose to the listeners a question. So we'll see if you've listened to the end of our podcast today. One I did not have a chance to ask here, but I thought it might be interesting to think about. What would Cormoran Strike see if he looked into the mirror of Erised? If you have an idea about that, what would Cormoran Strike see? A warm pair of socks, right? What would Cormoran Strike
no,
see if
just
he looked
one.
In the mirror of Erised?
Just no, one.
Oh, Louise. Oh, my gosh. Oh,
sorry.
Man. Oh, God. Feel free to give us as creative an answer as you like to that question. You can contact us at readingwritingrolling@gmail.com. You can contact us on our Facebook page or through Read, Write, Roll on Twitter. And now I'm going to leave you with the wise words of Albus Percival Wulfric Brian Dumbledore, who said, "Words are, in my not so humble opinion, our most inexhaustible source of magic, capable of both inflicting injury and remedying it." We'll see you next time when we'll be using our words to make some magic.